Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is June 28th, 2006. Today's session is entitled, What Are Public Policy Things to Think About? How Does the Death Penalty Work? It is presented by Ingrid Christensen. The number is CHI2006-2. Let's listen in.
I'm here today doing the second of three presentations on the death penalty, which is what I do. I make my living on the death penalty. I'm one of thousands of people across the country that make a pretty good living because we have a death penalty. It comes out of your pockets. We will get to that today. My job is a mitigation specialist, which is a person who does the sentencing part of trials. In a death penalty trial or a capital trial, there is the guilt and innocence part of the trial where the determination of guilt or innocence is made. And then there's a brief interim, kind of a little January term trial, where they determine whether or not the defendant, assuming he's been found guilty or she's been found guilty, whether or not the defendant is eligible for death. And there are certain qualifications. Every state has different eligibilities, and the federal government does, and the military does. And then, assuming the person is determined to be both guilty, part one, eligible, part two, then we go to what we call the penalty phase, which is part three of a trial, where the penalty is decided upon by the jury. By law now, it's by the jury, at least in Illinois. I'm not sure whether that's a federal law or not. Unless the defendant waives the jury and says the judge can decide. And during the penalty phase, there are two kinds of activities primarily. One is that the prosecution puts on what they call aggravation. And that is all the aggravating factors of the crime, and they're always horrific. They bring out the grieving family, and they have the family explain the impact this has had on their lives. They bring out the photographs of the crime scene and show what a terrible thing happened here, and it's an awful thing. I have lots of thoughts about that, too, because I also do, as a different part of my job, I do victim outreach, where I spend time with the families, the victims' families, in these capital cases. Then comes the defense, which I am part of, and what we put on what we call mitigation. So first the prosecution puts on aggravation, then we put on mitigation. And in the mitigation, we put on the path, the journey of this person's life. What led to the place in their life where they did this terrible thing? And of course, I don't think it's human nature to do terrible murders, to kill other people. But I can be wrong, but it seems that way to me. I haven't had a client yet for whom there was not a clear path that demonstrated how it came to be that this crime happened. So my job is to spend normally a couple of years researching the person's life. I talk to the person extensively in prison. I go and sit in jail and talk with them or her. I've had several women clients. And listen and listen and listen. And ask follow-up questions and listen some more to what's on their mind, what's on their hearts, what's happening with them, where they've been, what their story is. Then I talk to a wide circle of people around them. Anybody I can get my hands on that has known them at any point in their life, their sisters and brothers, their parents, their grandparents, their children, their friends, their old school chums, their kindergarten friends, their whatever, their army friends. And then I try to get all of their records for their whole life. So I try to get their mother's prenatal records. I try to get the records from if they have an illness that runs in the family, that the family is has a depressive disorder or is schizophrenic or something, I try to get all of the records from the family members who have those things. And I get all of their school records and their medical records and their certainly their birth records, their military records, their incarceration records, whatever sorts of records I can get. And then I try to figure out what I think is wrong with this person, because inevitably there's something wrong. So when I have sort of a grip on that, I talk to the lawyers. I'm not a lawyer. I talk to the lawyers on the team about that. And then we decide what sorts of specialists, expert witnesses, we're going to hire. And then we might get somebody who's a neuropsychologist, or we might get, you know, of course we do a flat-out psych exam. We immediately do a intelligence test, because it's become illegal in this country to execute people who are retarded. So if you're, that's being defined differently in the courts as we proceed, but it's around 70 IQ. So if you can get that, of course, then you're off the hook. That's great. So those are the kinds of things that I do with my life, in my work. And last time I told some, for those of you who were there, on Monday I told some stories about people who I've had as clients, some of my clients who are facing the death penalty, and the path. I told the path. I told the story that led to the place in their life where this thing happened. Today, my topic is public policy issues, and this is where you come in. I just wanted to alert you to a whole list of issues, which if you could see it, since I wrote it on the board back here, it goes A through I. So I don't know how many that is, but whatever, A, B, C, D, you know, quite a few. And
nine.
Eventually, thank you. Eventually I will raise this, and then you'll be able to see the agenda for the day. But it's first I'm going to do a little bit on the global picture about the death penalty, then I'm going to go to domestic United States of America. And under the domestic, I'm going to do innocent people, the speediness of trials, race issues, place issues, poverty issues, political issues, death penalty as a deterrent, and the expense of the death penalty. And I'm hoping to kind of buzz through those in time to give us all time to talk together. And I have a couple of overheads that I'm going to do as soon as I get into the U.S. part, away from the global, and then we'll get rid of this and have more light. So let me go through the global stuff first. Any comments or questions? Anything that's worrying you or that I left out?
I had a quick question about your, and you may want to not talk about this right now, but you said you cross over the river and you're on the other side, you're on the victim's family. Is that volunteer?
No,
we're paid. It's paid, and are you going to talk about that at all?
I would like to. On my next session on this, I'm going to do our faith issues and the death penalty. It's a tiny, I'll just say a word about it now. It's a tiny field. Even my work, mitigation, is a pretty small field. It's new, it's just growing. But an even smaller part of this work is defense-based victim outreach. And that is the defense team persuading the judge to pay for hiring someone who's been trained, and I have, in talking to the victim's family. Because our court system is so adversarial. You know, it's designed to be two sides, whatever the grade shall meet, we're both going to use all of our wiles and guiles and fight each other. But it's inhumane, and it's stupid. And the defense team knows some things that would comfort the victim's family that it wouldn't hurt the victim's family to know. And the defense team has access to knowledge that the prosecution will never have, because we know the defendant. And so if the family, you know, if the mother of the murdered daughter can't sleep at night because she wants to know, was her daughter's murderer crazy or evil? Which is in one case with a question that the woman had that I talked to. Is he evil? Is it the presence of evil? Or is this person mentally ill? And And we arranged to have her meet with the psych doctor who had done the evaluation, because we thought that would be sort of an objective way to address that issue. And it was a great comfort to the mother. Another case that I have listened to the people speak, I haven't talked with personally, they said this was a high-profile case and it was constantly coming up on the news. And they said, if we could get it to just go away, like dropping a stone in the ocean, we would take the death penalty off the table. We would want, if he could be locked up for life and just disappear, and promise never to have it come up on the news again, never to grant an interview, that would be what we need, because it's so painful to turn on the news and not know if your daughter's that same photograph is going to be there. And they could have accomplished that, so they did that. You know, so there are, sometimes it results in the death penalty coming off the table, not always, but it's a wonderful field. And they do trainings in it every summer, if anybody's interested, at Eastern Mennonite University. They have something called the Summer Peace Institute. And at the Summer Peace Institute, they do a training for, I think it's 3 weeks, on doing defense-based victim outreach. So if you're looking for a new career, I'd recommend it. There's a real need. There's tons of people that would like to hire such a competent person if they could find one. Globally, let me just say a few things. The trend in the last 30 years globally has been toward abolition of the death penalty. We are one of 4 countries globally that's been expanding our use of the death penalty in the face of, let's see if I can find the number here, 40 countries since 1985 have abolished the death penalty. 40 countries. Russia, Turkey, you know, if you made a list of all those countries plus the United States and said, which of these countries will have more death penalty in 40 years and which of them will have none, how many of you would have thought it would be the United States that would be the one with more? And 4 countries in that time have adopted the death penalty, and one of them immediately reversed their adoption. That was Nepal. So only 3 have adopted it in the last 40 years. We've constantly expanded our definition of what is a crime that we can execute people for. There's no other member of NATO that has the death penalty. We're too proud to be an American, those of you who are. The Canadians in the room can sit up straight because you don't have it. 4 countries this past year, in 2005, accounted for 94% of the executions in this world, on the globe, globally, 4 countries. You're dreading what I'm going to say, aren't you? China, Iran, the Congo, and
the
U.S. 8 countries since 1990, 8 countries on the globe executed children, people who committed the crime when they were under 18. China, Congo, Iran, Nigeria, Pakistan, Saudi Arabia, Yemen, and the United States. And we, by far, had the greatest number. We had 19. Since 1990, that was. Since 1990, we have executed 19 people who were 17 or younger at the time of the crime. Some as young as 14. Makes you proud to be an American. Another issue about the death penalty nationally is that foreign nationals are routinely denied their rights from the Geneva Conventions about being able to call their consulate when they've been arrested on a crime. And so I've already had one of those clients myself. You know, a British citizen completely denied his rights to let the British consul know that he'd been arrested and was being charged for the death penalty crime. 19 people last year in Mexico on death row had that experience. I mean, in Texas, from Mexico. So we don't honor the Geneva Convention, And it's an issue. I mean, when I met with the British Council, I went to London to do it, they were furious, and they were mounting a campaign against the United States because we were being so barbaric about this. And I've read other accounts of other countries that are equally furious with us for our position on the death penalty. So those are my global comments. Now I'm going to turn to domestic issues in Paris. You might just like to know, let's do these states. You might like to know about your state, so let's just have a look at them. Death row inmates by state. I think this is this year, or last year, I mean. Oh, here, six. No, this is when my computer printed it out. But I think it's last year, 2005. So if you're curious about your state, how many people are on death row, you can see that In Illinois, we commuted the sentences of everybody on death row 3 years ago, and we exonerated four people, one of whom was one of my clients. But so we emptied out about 170 people from death row, and now we've been hard at work filling up death row again, so we're back up to nine. But other states have not had that experience, although I think Maryland has had that experience. So, you know, obviously Texas is the worst. Where is Texas?
California
has got 652. Texas only has 404 people, but of course Texas executes them as opposed to California that doesn't march them off to death row very often. So Texas has a sort of fast machine of execution.
Your figures are more up to date than you think. April 1st, 2006.
Right, top line.
Above. Oh, okay, good. So that's... I'm doing pretty well. Florida has 392, Pennsylvania has 232, Ohio 195, Alabama 191. Alabama, there can't be more than 191 people in that state. North Carolina, Arizona 126, Tennessee 108. So then the numbers go down. New Mexico is down to 2. 12 states don't have the death penalty at all. In those states, Attorney General Ashcroft said that he was determined, you know, he quit a couple years ago, and now we have Attorney General Gonzalez, who's following in Ashcroft's footsteps, but he said that he wanted to have federal cases tried in each non-death penalty state as often as possible, so that the people in those states, like Minnesota, North Dakota, would become accustomed to the death penalty, and then they would vote it in. So it's a campaign on the part of the Attorney General's office to try federal cases in the states where there is not the state death penalty. Aren't you glad that the Republicans are in office? Okay, so then let's look at the other one of those two, the statistics, just so we can get them. This is an interesting... Well, size of death row by year, 68 to the present, how many people are actually, you can see when it goes, when it went down, when we, in Illinois, somewhere in here it went down because we got our 170 people off of death row. But anyhow, that's sort of as many people as our weight. Right this year, in 2005, there were 3,373 people awaiting execution in the United States. We only do executions now. We've cut down on our variety of styles of executing people. We only either electrocute or use drugs. The drugs we use, I'm sure you've been reading about the controversy. The drugs we use, the National Veterinary Association has said they would never use, they would find it illegal to use the drugs we use to execute human beings to put down dogs and cats because they're too painful. So we won't use them, thank God, on our dogs and cats, but we will use them on our humans. Some of us remember what the country was like in 1968, 1970, 72, 74. Remember there was a uprising, a movement, there were kinds of turmoil. There was those of us who were radicals were making trouble all the time, and you know, there was fighting in the streets and demonstrations. But we didn't have very much activity on death row. But for some reason, starting around 84, it starts to shoot up. And now, so I don't know that the country has changed so, but we certainly believe in killing people more from 84 until now.
I think in 77, almost all the states that had death penalty statutes, they were found unconstitutional. And
that's
as a result
right.
of that.
We started in 76, actually, the law was overturned or something, so that we started filling it up again.
Mm-hmm.
So we seem to be getting along okay without the death penalty for a little while in there, but now we're obviously doing much better because we have a lot more of it. So that's interesting to me. One of the things that you should know about that is that it's not a deterrent, the death penalty. Endless studies have been done on deterrence. Whether having the death penalty in a given state will make you safer if you live in that state. And as it turns out, the opposite is true. It's not just neutral. The opposite is true. In 2003, 44% lower homicide rates in non-death penalty states than in death penalty states. In 2002, it was only 36% lower homicide rates, and then it went up to 44% in 2003. The top 13 states for homicide are all death penalty states. When you bring the death penalty into a state, the homicide rate goes up. They've just done all these studies on it, and so death penalty. But when I was in South Africa after Mandela was out of Robben's Island, but before liberation, and they were getting ready for liberation. You know, the change was coming. And we went to a lecture by somebody who studied violence in South Africa, and he said what they found overwhelmingly was that when you brought violence into a community, even if you empowered people in that community to fight for their own liberation with guns, with violence, that domestic violence went up, that homicides went up, that neighbor against neighbor violence went up. That once you open the door to violence of any kind, you get violence. So I think maybe the fact that we sanction state-sponsored killing gets into people's souls or hearts or conscience somehow and allows them to say, well, I can kill people. We can all kill people. The state can kill people. I don't know, but that's the only way I can make sense of that. But it is certainly true that when you bring the death penalty, your murder rates go up.
Ingrid, if it's not a deterrent, is it cheaper?
No.
That's one of my favorite, that's my last point up here. We're starting at the bottom, not going as our efforts, that's all right. It is, North Carolina last year did a study on the expense of its death penalty cases compared to trying someone for a comparable murder and just giving them natural life in prison. And they found that the death penalty cases in North Carolina cost $2.16 million more for each one. The general statistics you read are that an execution, if you call for the death penalty in a case and try it and the person is convicted and sentenced to death and given the rights that he has for I say he, but you know what I mean, he and she, the rights that they have for appeal, that it is for between 3 and 6 times more costly for the taxpayer. So every time the state calls for the death penalty, I mean, you can stop this process at some point. In Illinois, many, many, many of my cases get pled out, which means the ticker stops running on finances. But if they don't get pled out, if they go all the way through the process and go into appeals, they're between 3 and 6 times more expensive than locking that same 18, 19, or 20-year-old kid up for the balance of their life. So that's a lot of the taxpayers' dollars. I mean, you know, every single time they ask for the death penalty, even if it gets pled out, a million of the taxpayers' dollars are gone. Whereas if they just try the kid and, you know, throw away the key, which I don't advocate, but that's what they can do. They're allowed to do that, and it's legal in every state. It's much cheaper. It's much cheaper. So, thanks for the question, Barbara. should we look at those other two things, and then we can get rid of this thing? Race. I think these are both, oh, these are on race. The facts about race. One of the ways in which the death penalty is a sin, in my view, is that it is so racially biased. If we, in the United States, believe that we should have a criminal justice system where you have equal opportunity under the law and equal access to a fair trial, that's our goal. We are falling far short of our goal. It is simply not true. I'm going to read you a little bit about that. One of my favorite lawyers who does death penalty work is a guy called Stephen Bright. If you ever have an opportunity, he's a Christian, and he just shamelessly includes his Christianity in all of his talks to public defenders and all these people. He's just fabulous, and he's such a wonderful guy. But here's a thing he wrote. From arrest to sentencing, the criminal justice system treats people differently based on their race. A person of color is more likely than a white person to be stopped by the police. Lots of studies corroborate that. You know, in Chicago we have a phrase, driving while black.
DW.
You probably have it where you live too. To be abused by the police during that stop. Again, you know, all these things are well researched. The numbers are here if you want to actually come and look at the research. To be arrested once you've been stopped. The likelihood of being arrested if you're black is much higher, if you're a person of color. To be denied bail is then the next step up. You're much higher likelihood. To be charged with a serious crime is the next step up. To be convicted of that crime is the next step up. And to receive a harsher sentence is the next step up. For example, in Georgia, a white person is 3 to 6 times more likely to be put on probation than a person of color. So race is really dangerous in the criminal justice system. The prosecutor can decide in every case. The prosecutor makes 2 major decisions about the death penalty. They decide whether or not to seek the death penalty. It's not a conference between the prosecutor and the defense. It's not a conference between the prosecutor and the judge. It's not a conference between a neutral panel and the prosecutor. The prosecutor himself, by himself, can decide, shall we seek the death penalty in this case? Most prosecutors decide yes when they have an opportunity to. Lots of them do. Although it varies tremendously from state to state. There's actually a mock wing. Oh, no, that's a defense. Sorry. So that's their first thing. The second thing is a prosecutor can decide whether or not to accept a plea. It isn't the defense. It isn't anybody else. It's the prosecutor. So the prosecutors, if they are racist, and 97% of all prosecutors are white, so I'm not saying that makes them racist, but I just mean that there's so few persons of color who serve in that role. They can decide these major, major things, partly about our pocketbooks, but partly about our soul. So race is a huge issue. Most recently, the U.S. Department of Justice examined its own record on the use of the death penalty and found that over 3/4 of the people given the death penalty were members of racial minorities. Over half were African Americans. Now, I know that doesn't jive with this. Stephen Bright wrote this article a couple of years ago, so maybe the numbers have changed a little bit, but it's high anyhow. You know, 12 or 13% of the country are African Americans. 60% of all victims of crimes are African Americans. 60% of all murder victims are African Americans. But, you know, even by these numbers, the defendants are, you can't really see that, can you? The top section is white. This is Hispanic. This is black. And that's other. So by these numbers, it is not quite, it's about, what, 60%, 40% or something. But I've seen much more dramatic numbers about that, so I don't know whether this is true or not. This is deathpenaltyinfo.org. Race of victims, you can't tell by that, tell this either, can you? We have the actual thing here.
Yeah, the percentages are
Yeah, you can see the percentages. Yeah. And you can see these, this colored graph. But the U.S. Department of Justice agrees that there's a serious problem. African Americans constitute 12% of the national population. They are victims of half of the murders that are committed in this country. 80% of those on death row are there for crimes against white people. That's the other one of these sheets. That's the other.
It says on the bottom of that one.
Oh, it's down here?
It says, yeah it's the
The race of the victims. Okay, so 80% of the victims are white. Mm-hmm. So if you're a black victim, and the numbers that I see pretty consistently are that about 60% of the victims are black, but you're not going to get, your assailant is not going to get the death penalty. But if you're a white victim, it is. And that's how it breaks down. So white folks are more valuable to us, so we give the death penalty for people who kill white folks and don't to people who kill black folks. Okay, let's change to the other. This is persons executed for interracial murders in the U.S. since 1976. Here, with a white defendant and a black victim, we've executed 12 people. And with a black defendant and a white victim, we've executed 213 people. Current U.S. death row population by race, again, 41.42% are black, 10.5% are Hispanic, 45% are white, and other is 2.3%. So white people, I mean, usually the stereotype of people on death row is that they're black. But actually, there's more white people on death row. I think that's, I'm not sure how to explain that, but that's, but in terms of the ratio of people who are murdered, the ratio is so much higher. But, you know, the 12% of the population that's black is incarcerated at such a higher rate. So now we can get rid of that. Thank you. Thank you for my to my assistants for doing that. Do you think I'll do anything bad? I'll just pop this up. There. Good. And can we turn on lights over there, Mark?
There's the light behind.
The one on the wall. Great. Let there be light. So, I want to have us have time to talk, but let me just show. We've done expensive, not a deterrent. I haven't done political, haven't done poverty. A little bit about place. If you want the death penalty to be applied equally, you know, fairly, like depending on the magnitude of the crime, that is another way that goal is defeated is because the place where these crimes happen determines so dramatically what happens to you. You know, obviously you could be in one of the 12 states that doesn't have the death penalty. That would be good for you if you were the defendant, because then you wouldn't be charged in that way. in Houston. Houston is the death penalty capital of the United States. More people are executed there in the last 25 years than in any state, than have been executed in any state except Texas and Virginia. And Houston has one-third of the people who are on death row. But in Dallas, which has evidently many more murders than Houston, they have a quarter of the number of death cases than Houston does. So do your crime in Dallas, for God's sake. Don't do it in Houston. And the same is true between Philadelphia and Pittsburgh. And the same is true in the various counties in Georgia. Depending on where you do your crime, you will either get charged with a death case or not. So there's no pretense even that, depending on the magnitude of the crime.
Is there a correlation for crime rate in that city? Like, Houston developed that because there was such a crime. I mean, that's my logical thinking, that they have the death penalty.
No, there was actually a prosecutor there who was just death penalty crazy. One particular person.
Not driven fairly by the crime.
No, there's more crime in Dallas than there is in Houston. So that's
not correlated.
No, it's not. Manhattan and the Bronx, if you're going to do a crime in New York, don't do them in Manhattan or the Bronx. But don't do them in the other three boroughs, because you will get much more likely to be charged with a death crime in the other three boroughs. But those two boroughs, you're okay. So it's, what kind of a justice system is that? What's that about? You know, it's just not. They don't have it in North Dakota, but they do have it in South Dakota. So, so that's that one. Place is bad. Race is bad. Speed, I'll just say a word or two. There's a movement afoot in the land to speed up the wheels of justice, you know, the whole right to a speedy trial, et cetera. And speaking as someone who works in the grinding along in the middle of that machinery, I can tell you that speed harms my work. I can guarantee you that if a speedy outcome is what's called for, my client will receive a serious disservice. I need about 3 years to get to the place where I'm ready to go to trial and can do it properly. I'll do it in two, but you have no idea the number of phone calls I get asking me to take cases where they've got 6 weeks. You know, or something like that. A judge will get a bee in his bonnet, we're gonna have to do this in a hurry, or the prosecutor has got an election coming up and he wants to do it right away.
What is the relative shortage of people in your position to be helpful that way? Is it like there's such a small percentage that they can't go to anybody else but you? I don't think I understand that.
Well, we're doing...
Is my question clear?
Do you want to ask it again?
Okay. You say that you're getting phone calls of where they want you to come and work a miracle in 6 weeks. Could they not have a year before gone to somebody else, but there is nobody else because there aren't many people in the field? That's what I'm trying to ask. Is
there is some of that problem, and there's some problem of people not realizing that they...
Well, they don't even realize they have the option. Is that maybe it?
Right. They didn't think that prosecution was going to be serious, so they didn't think they had to take it seriously. They thought it would bleed out, or, you know, there are a variety of stories. There's a lot of ineptitude. There's a lot of just plain people who didn't get on their horse when they should have. But even when they do get on their horse when they should have, they sometimes are really speeded up way beyond the realm of reason.
I've worked in the criminal justice system for about 25 years, and I think that one of the great difficulties we face as a nation is the quality of legal counsel defending. And I'm sure you're going to touch on the poverty, but that's connected with the question that was just asked. We have a lot of attorneys assigned to do this for a little amount of money without the requisite skill set it takes to effectively defend a capital case.
Yes, exactly. It's frightening how true that is.
Yeah. If you had unlimited resources, how quickly could it be done? Let's say you had a staff of 10, 15 people that you could have doing all this work for you. I'm just wondering what's going on during the 2 years.
Part of it is trust building. it's peeling an onion with the family. You have to get the family to admit to a whole lot of stuff that they don't want to admit to. You know, they sexually abuse their kid or they whatever. There's all family secrets. Trust building just your client. Get your client to understand that he has to bust his family if he is unwilling to. There are human issues like that. There are finding people issues. But if I had a huge staff who could find people easily, and if I could send out good interviewers to go and interview, I could probably do a case in 6 months. Yes, if I could spend a lot of time with the client and with the family so that I could work through some of those issues. So it's, and I got called on a military case recently, somebody who killed a couple of officers in Vietnam, friendly fire. I mean, Iraq, Vietnam. Don't tell my age.
There isn't much difference.
There's not much difference, you're right. And they wanted to do it in 3 months or something. You know, and I said, already the military, it's going to be tried in a military tribunal. Already we're talking about a lynching, and now you want to do a lynching in 3 months instead of 3 years? You know, I didn't turn it down for that reason. I turned it down for some other reasons, but it made me pretty nervous. So that's speed. Now we're at innocent people, poverty, which is the huge, huge, huge issue here, and political. So, I don't have much time, I'll hurry. Political, a lot of prosecutors are political people. They're going to run for public office, they're going to, you know, do this, do that, and they get in the news a lot with these cases. So political things are well documented to influence this. They influence whether or not they're going to ask for the death penalty. They influence whether or not. I just had a political case a month ago where everybody was lined up to accept a plea bargain, but the prosecutor wanted to try the case because he wanted the news coverage. So politics affects this mightily. And of course, elections and state politics around whether or not you have the death penalty. Right now, Wisconsin is facing it. Wisconsin has to decide in the next few months whether or not they're going to vote in the death penalty in Wisconsin, which they haven't had since 1832 or something like that. So political is big. Innocent people. I should give you a few numbers on that. Since 1973, 122 people who have been through the criminal justice system, tried, convicted, gone under their appeals, you know, the system has done its thing, 122 of them have been found to be innocent since the advent of DNA testing. So the system did its whole thing. They were just waiting execution. And 122 people were wrongfully convicted. The system doesn't work. In Illinois, we had at one point, before our governor commuted the sentences of everybody on death row because he figured out the system didn't work, we had executed 12 people, and we had found 13 people in the same period of time to be innocent. Through flukes, through this class at Northwestern. Every year a journalism teacher at Northwestern would tell his class to choose one case to interview, to investigate for the year, and see whether they could find evidence that the person was innocent. It was a class project. And 3 years in a row, they proved that their person was innocent. These were people who were convicted and on death row. No, what kind of a fluke is that? Is that the criminal justice system working? I don't think so. So there's a lot of innocent people. 25 different states have had innocent people. The day before I came up to Holden, there was a headline in the Chicago Tribune saying that they had just found that someone they had executed in Texas was innocent. Well, you know a lot of those Texas people are innocent, but just last week they found another one who had been executed. So according to Amnesty International, 23 people since 1973 are known to be innocent who were executed in the United States. So 23, I mean, there are politicians who run for office who say that they are collateral damage in the war on crime. That you and I sponsor, the state sponsors killing people, United States citizens, as collateral damage in the war on crime. We're bound to make a few mistakes. We're sorry. What if it was your brother or you, which it could be?
What has been some of the payouts in those cases? Has the government had to pay out family who have been found innocent? And as also another completely different question, if people want to be executed, at what point can they give up their right to appeal? Do they have to go through all the appeals?
No, they can give up. As soon as they're given the death penalty, they can ask to not have any more.
Really?
Yeah. So there are a lot of volunteers out there. They have to be tried. And if I'm hired as a mitigation specialist on the case, even if the defendant orders me to do nothing, I have to do my job. The Supreme Court has backed that up. So at the initial trial, they will receive a representation. But let me tell you about poverty. Well, I wanted to tell you about Anthony Porter in this business of being innocent. Anthony Porter was this client in Illinois who was tried, convicted, went through appeals, convicted, reaffirmed the conviction, sent to death row, 17 years on death row, and just as he was about to be executed, someone discovered that he was, or someone finally acknowledged that he didn't get it, why he was being executed. And you can't be executed in the United States legally if you don't understand why you're being executed. So you're required to sort of grok what's going on. I'm being executed because I did this crime. And if you can't make that connection, then we have to restore you before you can be executed. So Anthony Porter, it turns out he's so retarded they couldn't restore him. And this was right before we outlawed executing retarded people. In fact, Anthony Porter was one of the reasons we did that. So they stayed his execution while they were going to do intelligence testing. And then he was one of the Northwestern University journalism student cases. And they did a DNA test and found that he was innocent. This poor guy, 17 years on death row, every door he went through had condemned stamped on it for 17 years. And they were about to execute him, and then they didn't. Now, poverty. I want to just read you. You are not entitled, once you have been tried, you are not entitled to a lawyer. Well, even before, while you're being tried, you're not entitled to a lawyer who is sober, awake, sane. And these are all things that have been reaffirmed by the courts. So let me read you Stephen Bright again. There's a great transcript from a trial here. During the critical post-conviction review of capital cases, those condemned to die are not even entitled to a sleeping lawyer. He had just been talking about all the lawyers that had been sleeping during capital cases, and the case could not be retried or turned over because the person who has to keep a record of whether or not the attorney is sleeping is the sleeping attorney. So it's a catch-22. So, but here you're not entitled to a sleeping lawyer. Xavius Gibson, whose IQ was found on different tests to be between 76 and 82, stood totally bewildered in front of a judge at his first state post-conviction hearing in Georgia without a lawyer. The case proceeded as follows. The court, okay, Mr. Gibson, are you ready to proceed? Mr. Gibson, I don't have an attorney. The court, I understand that. Mr. Gibson, I am not waiving my rights. The court, I understand that. Do you have any evidence to put up? Mr. Gibson, I don't know what to plead. The court, huh? Mr. Gibson, I don't know what to plead. The state of Georgia, which sought to bring about Gibson's execution, was represented by a lawyer who specializes in capital habeas corpus cases. After the state's lawyer presented testimony, the judge turned again to Mr. Gibson.
the court. Mr. Gibson, would you like to ask Mr. Boss any questions? Mr. Gibson. I don't have any counsel. The court, I understand that, but I'm asking, can you tell me yes or no whether or not you want to ask him any questions or not? Mr. Gibson, I am not my own counsel. Court, I'm sorry, sir, I didn't understand you. Mr. Gibson, I am not my own counsel. Court, I understand, but do you want to ask him anything? Mr. Gibson, I don't know. Court, okay, sir, okay, thank you, Mr. Mullis, you can go down. This was a hearing which determined whether Xavius Gibson would be put to death. So this is typical. I mean, there's so the paucity of decent lawyering for poor people in this country is a crime. That people in Illinois, they found that a third of all the lawyers who had lawyered the defendants' cases who were put sent to death row had had in the previous year either their license suspended or they were without a license. They just, you know, it's like, who cares? They're poor. Poverty is the single biggest predictor of what will happen to you if you are charged with a murder. So, so that is pretty scary, especially because we believe in equal protection under the law. Let's see if I can tell you anything more about poverty, and then let's talk. Page 23. Here's a transcript of this case where the lawyer was sleeping. His mouth kept falling open, and he kept tipping over and stuff. His sleeping did not offend the Sixth Amendment. The trial judge explained because the Constitution doesn't say the lawyer has to be awake. On appeal, the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals rejected McFarland's claim that he was denied his right to counsel over the dissent of two judges who pointed out that a sleeping counsel is unprepared to present evidence, to cross-examine witnesses, and to present any coordinated effort to evaluate evidence and present a defense. So there were two judges dissented, but they were overruled by the other judges who said, you're not entitled to sleep to an awake lawyer. And the United States District Court making the unremarkable observation that sleeping counsel is the equivalent to no counsel at all, granted him habeas corpus relief, but Texas appealed. The Texas Attorney General's office argued to the appellate court that a sleeping lawyer is no different from a lawyer who is intoxicated under the influence of drugs, suffering from Alzheimer's disease or mental illness. While this would seem to be an argument for upholding the district court's decision, it was not. Death sentences have been upheld in cases in which lawyers were drunk, drug impaired, suffering from Alzheimer's, and severe mental illness. So therefore, it was all precedent that this was okay. The judges even engaged counsel for Texas on the point, asking if there was not some difference between a lawyer who was under the influence of alcohol and one who was completely unconscious.
We're paying these people.
This is your country, people.
Yeah, how do they get away with that?
I said the people aren't.
What's wrong with people in the courtroom?
Creating a cruel catch-22, the two judges. This is the panel of the Fifth Circuit, reversed the grant of habeas corpus relief over a dissent that said the representation of Burdine's case shocks the conscience. They agreed that sleeping was just as acceptable as being drunk at a capital trial, but they agreed that it was just as acceptable. Creating a cruel catch-22, the two judges denied relief because the trial record did not show which portions of the trial Cannon was sleeping. Of course, the person responsible for making the record was Cannon himself, who was asleep. So these people get executed. So those are the things I wanted to say. Now, what would you like to say? I like this sort of death penalty. Is it inequity or iniquity? Or maybe we should say death penalty, inequity equals iniquity. case going up in a couple months to be heard, not at the Supreme Court, but to be heard in Washington, and we think at that time we're going to, it's to decide whether or not to seek death in a certain case, on a federal case, and they're imagining that they'll hear more. I think people don't know. It's too soon.
Well, I think in that category, political, that there's a subtext that isn't apparent, that is a huge factor in the United States of America, and that is the extent to which common religion of the people, American people, religion, American Christianity, as practiced, has an immense influence upon the way things go politically and in the judiciary and so on. What I'm getting at here is that I've extensively read Noam Chomsky, who's a very dissident intellectual, and he's really astute in this, that a number of people I work with are members of small congregations in which they are constantly being taught that you only really have to look at or consider the literal meaning of, and then they quote these various scriptures. And so if they can find any place there that if somebody even stubs somebody's toe, then they have to be put to death, that makes them and all the rest of the people that are part of that little congregation, and I know of five of them just that my co-workers go to, that in which that is the case. And what I want to get at here is there is a current of American Christianity that supports a political establishment that keeps this going. So it is, here, you don't find those people coming to Holden Village.
Yeah. Thank you.
I'm sorry.
I wanted you to think about this list of things in terms of going home, because some of these battles will come up in your home states, and it's our obligation, I think, as Christians to reclaim some moral high ground. Marty did a session on that, yesterday? John Marty, on the conservative Christians taking over the sort of moral high ground, and that other kinds of Christians that we think of as being more mainstream should get back in there and fight to say that we have something to say about the moral high ground here. I think that we have some obligation to work on some of these points when they come up in our communities and in our states. There was a question back here. Did you have one? Somebody had one?
You mentioned that we're one of four countries, right, that have the most deaths, right? Is there any other thing that you see besides the Christianity that you just mentioned that might, where does that roots come from? I mean, why are we up there with Congo and some of these other countries with the deaths? Why is that?
You could ask other people in the room who would know more than that. Do you have an idea?
No, but I have a question, which is, I don't know what we think. Is there an agreed upon thing that we think is happening when you go to prison, that you're supposed, are you being punished, or are you being fixed, or are you being held?
It's a really good question.
What is happening? Yeah. And if it's like, if we think that...
We used to call them reformatories.
Mm-hmm. Right. Because obviously if you're going to put somebody to death, it's because you think that you're there to punish them.
Right.
I mean, that's not going to fix them.
No. And prisons, are such a huge part of our budget now, and they're getting to be bigger and bigger. So
perhaps rather than when it comes up, doing something before it comes up in politics. And
those scam rats are so radical. Yeah, I think so.
Has the death penalty ever been eliminated in countries or states just simply because they go through these things, they say, well, whether you're ethically for it or not, it doesn't work, it's too expensive, et cetera, so why don't we just do something that's less expensive? Or no, we're not necessarily against it, but it doesn't work. And I mean, I'm just wondering if there's some people that could be almost swayed that way and kind of on a different agenda.
Yeah, it doesn't work. We make mistakes and do kill people who are innocent.
Right. And even if you're ethically, for it or whatever, I mean, just getting rid of it because it doesn't work.
It's too expensive. I mean, you'd think we would argue the same thing about war in Iraq. Mm-hmm. A little girl came up to me this morning and said, was it one of your kids?
Abby.
Yeah, Abby. What did she say? your argument, Barbara?
Why is it okay to kill people in this country when soldiers kill other people? Why don't we put soldiers in death row?
Out of the mouths of babes.
I was just wondering, so in the meantime of them, like, before they are, when they're on death row and they're just waiting, do they just wait in, like, a state prison, or, like, is...
Thank you. Good question. They wait, and in Illinois, before we got our 170 people off death row, the average wait was 11 and a half years. It varies from state to state how long they wait. They wait in supermax, maximum prisons, where they are warehoused, because we know they're going to be executed, so we don't feel we need to give them any programs or keep them busy or give them a job or let them take classes or anything like that. So I had my client who was released from prison because he was exonerated after 19 years on death row, Leroy Orange, had not in those 19 years received any education. He was a ninth grade dropout. And during those 19 years on death row, because he was going to be executed, he had received no drug treatment for his drug problem, no education, nothing. But they are warehoused, and they're warehoused in maximum security because the thought is in the criminal justice system that they have nothing to lose, so they might make a break for it, or they might, you know, take a hostage or something. I went 2 weeks ago to the Supermax in Florence, Colorado, which is where we put Massawi recently. There are 390-some prisoners there. It was fascinating. But the person I was going to see, who was the sort of godfather to a client of mine, and I needed to interview him about her years on the street under his tutelage and protection, hadn't talked to another human being for, I don't know how long, but a very long time. His food comes through a slot in the door. The sheriffs are ordered not to chat with the prisoners or talk to them. They might say a word or two. You know, they might say, shove your tray out, or, you know, something like that. But he gets out of his cell 1 hour a day, but the 1 hour a day when he's out, none of the other 11 people on his area are out, and he's put in a cage outdoors when he goes outdoors. So he's either in the cage outdoors or he's in the square little area where on his deck or his, you know, place. It's very modern. It's silver, shiny steel, stainless steel. And so when I came to talk to him, you know, I had 6 hours with him in a room with a glass between us. But we could, there was a sliding slot for documents, and we could touch fingers. So we did. But I would say it took him an hour to get to become present in the space that he was coming from so far away.
What was his mental status like? Because I think when we think about
he what... said that he had one of the least restrictive kinds of care there. So that someone like Massawi, who has cracks, he has schizophrenia, and he will melt down very quickly and just become a raving lunatic. My client's this man, was pretty sane when he went there, and he's extremely shut down, but he has more, evidently more. He can watch more hours of television. They can watch 3 hours of religious programming a day, and he's up to 6 hours of both religious and a couple of other kinds of programming or something. So he has that, and he can go and stand by the door of a man he knows, and they can somehow communicate some during their hour out. So he was not crazy, but he was very... like many layers of thick glass that we had to peel away before we could actually. Ann.
How do those conditions compare with not on death row, but life in prison?
Life in prison, when your family comes to visit you, if you're not on the row, you can go and sit at a picnic table or at an indoor table,
so
and
you can be,
hold your children on your lap, and you can share food with them, and you can have, this man had 2 phone calls a month that he could make, 2 15-minute phone calls a month. But normally you can have a phone call every day if you can afford it, but we charge huge amounts of money. We give a contract at every prison for the phone service, where the prices that you and I pay for long-distance calls are a tenth of what prisoners have to pay. So it's a tax on the poor, because most prisoners are poor, and either they have to pay it in prison or their family has to pay it, collect.
So, but they have more human contact even with...
And they can play
prisoners.
Basketball. They can play basketball, and, and they can play cards. And
the ones with no parole, I mean, life in prison.
Life in prison, you can have, you can belong to an AA group, you can form an AA group.
You can
take
classes.
You can sing together. Okay. I sometimes go into, you know, to see women prostitutes, and we sing. Mm-hmm. You can sign up for classes that are about distance learning. If people will mail you the stuff, you can get books.
I mean, this has been a very good forum in terms of bringing a lot of the issues, like bringing the awareness of things that are going on in the system. But practically speaking, when we do go back out away from Holden, what are some ways, like just some practical applications of how to be involved? Because we're not all involved with the prosecution or with the defense or with the state. I mean, you have the insider's perspective, being able to see how these things are playing out. But for those of us,
I would find
out
in your state what is happening. I would find out how to become a visitor at a prison. I would organize your congregation to adopt a prisoner. Who you send him books, go visit him, stuff like that. I would find out what the rules are about the death penalty in your state, and
yeah,
find
Ohio,
out
so,
whether there are any changes being contemplated by the legislature. I would just learn more about it, because really they would like it to just disappear. They don't want it to be public. And the more we inquire into it and shine a light into it, the better. There are lots of online services where you can look online, put in your state's name, and learn about the criminal justice system. I mean, I've only been doing this since the year 2000, and I'm just fascinated by what I'm learning about these systems. They vary so much, and the quality of care. I mean, I go into the Cass County Jail in Fargo, North Dakota, to see a client, and I can call him ahead of time and leave a message on a machine, which he can then, during his 4 hours of his phone being turned on in his cell, he can call his messages and listen to them. And it's clean and it's humane, and there are no cockroaches or rotten mice. And
I think we should be an encouragement to the public defenders who are doing a good job.
Yes, thank you.
They're working hard.
Wonderful.
There's a lot of good ones.
Yeah.
And we need to encourage them.
Yeah. The public
appreciate
defenders
it.
In Chicago are fabulous. I have just come to admire them tremendously and think that they're heroes. They just go back in there day after day, and they get defeated most of the time, and they go back to work, and they work hard. You're absolutely right. Thank you.
What is the correlation between these high numbers in the 4 countries you mentioned? Percentage of how much actual violent crimes? I mean, is there a correlation between... You know, China, the 4 countries have that. I mean, do we have way more violent crimes?
Well, I don't know those numbers, sorry.
I mean, because that's sort of an issue. I mean, of, you know, how much, you know, countries that don't have death penalties, do they just not have the violent crimes?
Yeah. I don't know. Have you seen that Michael Moore film about guns?
Yeah.
And how Canada has more guns than we do, but they've got, like, so much less murder. So... You know, it's important to figure out what the climate is, how you set a climate. I'm going to talk about the sort of religious and moral implications of this at my next session, but I think it's so important to think about what we will put up with as a climate or as a culture. The culture that says that it's okay to execute people for their crimes, I think is a culture that has a real deep cancer in it. we've gone over time, and I'm happy to stand here and answer questions, but I don't want to keep you beyond.
There's another session coming.
Oh, okay, so we have to get out of here.
Yeah.